how old were you when you thought to yourself or finally recognized that you wanted to get into environmentalism, or was there a point of realization? Where were you and what were the influences that made you decide to get into the movements of today?
Well, it was really sort of a long journey, and I've thought about things like that. Probably it started when I was very young, and we traveled with the circus, and I got to know different animals, and I always felt like I could communicate with them. It sounds weird, but even when I was a little bit kid, you know, I felt like I could communicate with them, and I could sympathize with them being in those cages and being trained, and I could feel their moods, and I felt like they could feel how I felt. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know them there, and then when we moved, my mother and I moved back to Sarasota, Florida. In Naples, Florida, I lived on the beach a lot. I just stayed on the beach a lot and really got into nature there, because it was so sparsely inhabited at the time that it was like the last outpost of the old Everglades. Mm-hmm. And it was just awesome. It was incredibly beautiful. And then I had to come up here when I was 7 because my mother was killed in a car wreck. It was real hard for me to adjust to the mountains, because formerly I had had the whole ocean to look at and look over, and now I was hemmed in by mountains. And it wasn't until I was about 13 or 14 or 15, somewhere in there, I started going up on Chihuahua with my friends, that I started getting back into an appreciation of nature. And from that time, I did some hiking and fishing and swimming, a good bit of that. And then when I went to California, I started hanging out with folks in the Haight-Ashbury, and they were all getting into nature trips, and we'd go hang out in Golden Gate Park, and you'd get such a big contrast between the cement-covered city and the well, semi-natural park, that and then going out to the ocean, that it really made you think. And then I would go spend some time hanging out in the country around Oregon and Washington, Mount Shasta and all those places with friends of mine, and had wilderness experiences that were just incredible, just and in Yosemite and different places like that. And so I knew I wanted to live outside as much as I could. I hated being in a house, and I wanted to be outside all the time, so I went to live in Hawaii with some friends of mine, and I was able to live outside a lot there. And but then I saw the condos coming and the island just being raped and plundered from one side to the other, and I knew that I had to get active and get involved and do something, because what I enjoyed the most in life was just being destroyed.
That was in Hawaii?
Yes.
Where the condos came. So you saw it being removed from its natural state into the concrete jungle now that it is, right?
Yeah.
How about the Everglades? You mentioned the Everglades. What kind of... Have you been back there recently?
The last time I was there was in 78. I'd really like to go back again soon. My husband and I are hoping to get to the point where we can start traveling again. But the Everglades are a really mystical place. You have to be very tough to live there, because the severe conditions, I mean, even though you've got all that great water, you got all that heat and humidity and killer mosquitoes and killer crocodiles and coral snakes and pygmy rattlers, and but at the same time you've got forest of palmetto and incredibly beautiful. It's a unique habitat. There's nowhere on earth like the Everglades. And it, I really admire the Seminoles who used to live down there. I got into their culture a little bit when I lived there. And they were extremely resourceful and inventive. And there's something about living in a harsh environment like that and yet making a good living, being healthy, and treating the land right, that's just very captivating.
What do you know about the Seminoles and how they use the land?
Well, I know that they migrated down, of course, from the northern areas, from Alabama. They were Creek Indians who migrated to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew how to wisely, or more wisely, use the land than we do. They were able to sustainably hunt. And, of course, fortunately, they hadn't discovered concrete or asphalt or anything. And they were fantastic fishermen and craftsmen. And they knew how to hunt all the local animals without overhunting. They had limited agriculture. They, from what I understand, they did cultivate some crops, but not as we do now.
Mm-hmm.
With, of course, they didn't do the irrigation to divert the water from the Everglades like is being done now.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just very strong people. You know, they knew how to cover themselves with certain types of mud and herbs to keep all those mosquitoes off of them.
Really?
And they knew how to build houses that, you know, the hurricanes came, wouldn't be a total loss. And they knew how to stay away from the hurricane areas when hurricanes would come. They migrated and from one part to the other, different seasons, and they took advantage of the land without plundering it.
That's interesting. Let's see. Have you ever spoken up in a workplace, school, or organization about an activity or policy that had popular support that bothered you? And if you have, what happened?
Well, when I came back here from Hawaii, I was in the process of getting out of a sort of disastrous marriage, and I finally ended up getting a job at Anniston Army Depot, and I worked there for about 8 years and went through the divorce and got on my feet financially, and I worked myself into a position of supervisor, first line supervisor, which had its advantages and disadvantages. But there were there was a lot, actually, of no consciousness type of situation there. People didn't know anything about how to treat the environment. While I was there, they were just in the process of realizing that they shouldn't put trichloromethylene into the groundwater, that they should dispose of it in a more environmentally safe manner. And until they reached that decision, they had what they called a lagoon where they had this toxic stuff running through a pipe and back out to be aerated, but it didn't change the nature of it. It was still trichloromethylene. And they were constantly unearthing drums where this stuff had been buried, and it was degreasers and paint thinners and things like that. Constantly unearthing, leaking 55-gallon drums and taking them to this lagoon site and pouring them into the lagoon so they could figure out what to do next. Well, finally, now they're bottling or putting all this stuff back into drums and taking it down to Emil, which, of course, is really not the best solution either. But it's better than letting it leak into the groundwater, and that stuff's been found in wells all around the depot and people's drinking wells. And it's known to cause cancer and different problems like that. So I spoke up about that, and it was very unpopular. And then at the time, they were also starting on the nerve gas controversy. And I knew how I felt about that. I knew I had worked out there long enough and heard enough about what went on out in the restricted areas with the nerve gas. And I knew enough about the general run of people that worked there that there's no way that I would trust my life to them in incineration-type technology with an open smokestack. So seeing the handwriting on the wall, I knew I had to leave, I had to get out of there. So I started going to college at night to finish up my degree because I'd only had a year here at JSU before I left in the late 60s to go to California. So I got a good bit of my college out of the way, and then I remarried, and after my husband and I got settled, he told me I should just quit work and finish up my degree, which I did. And I'm so glad. I was so very glad to be away from there because I'm sure they would have fired me by now anyway. So.
How recent was that about the diverting of the trichloromethylene from the holding pond bottles or whatever?
It was going on the whole time I was there from about 1980 to about 89. Mm-hmm. And in 89, I know that they were starting to get it back in containers to ship it out. Mm-hmm. And now it's been declared a Superfund site. Mm. And that's the area they want to build a nerve gas incinerator. Mm-hmm. It's already a Superfund site.
Mm-hmm. Which means?
That, you know, a Superfund site is designated by the EPA as being one of the hot spots in the U.S. It's got tons of toxic waste. It's a potential public health hazard. Mm-hmm. And now they want to build a nerve gas incinerator there. So, you know, it's like insult to injury or injury to injury. It's sad.
Well, you obviously feel pretty adamant about the incinerator. Do you have any further thoughts you'd like to share with me on that?
Well, it's just, it's sort of frightening. There's such a, it looks like there's going to be such a good possibility that it's going to come in here that my husband and I have been discussing what we're going to do. And we're going to fight it as long as we can, help fight it. We helped found the Families Concerned About Nerve Gas Incineration, and although we haven't had an opportunity to be real active with them in about the past year or so, we certainly support what they do and try to support them every chance we get. Our main focus for about the past 2 years has been working on a potential wilderness area. And as soon as we can get done with that, and we intend to put more time into the families group. But what they're doing is really important, and if the effort to keep the incinerator out fails, then we know that, like a lot of other people, we're just going to have to relocate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You said you were working on a wilderness area. We're
working on part of the national forest that's about 10 miles from JSU. It's a mountain ridge that extends for about 10 miles going from southwest to northeast angle, almost to the Georgia border between Piedmont and Jacksonville. And it's a fairly undisturbed area. It was logged over a good bit between about 1860 and 1920, but it's been growing back a lot since then. There's the tallest ridges have not been logged at all, and it's extremely biodiverse area, and we're studying about 16,000 acres of it, hoping that we can get somewhere between 14 and 16,000 set aside as congressionally designated wilderness to not be clear-cut or bothered at all. Of course, it'll still be open to hunting and fishing and hiking and mountain biking and all that good stuff, but no cutting.
Any kind of endangered species or plants or animals that you found?
We found some plant species of special concern. And we believe we've got some endangered plant species. We just haven't found them yet. Mm-hmm. And we've got about over 2,000 specimens that we've only gotten about 30% identified. So we don't know what we've gotten there. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of animal sign and different animals that, while they're not threatened or endangered on the federal listing, they are threatened and endangered in reality. Mm-hmm. Because their habitats are shrinking so much. But we've got a lot of hummingbirds and bobcat and otter and hawks, owls, just a lot of different types of wildlife that need protection.